Hi, I'm Susie Larson. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast from Live the Promise. There are many more podcasts available up on the website at myfaithradio.com, and your support makes this possible. Thank you. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise. And we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Really glad to have you listening today. So here's a loaded question, and I think I already know the answer because it would be a surprise if you answered no to this one. But have you ever been stabbed in the back? Has someone said something about you, betrayed you, hurt you so deeply that you were bitter and it was hard for you to forgive them? Well, chances are that answer is yes, and hopefully you and I, we've worked through those issues and been able to extend forgiveness as Christ has forgiven us. In fact, unforgiveness really isn't an option for a Christ follower because of what Jesus modeled, what he calls us to. But let's take it to a whole new level. What if someone hurt, abducted, attempted the life of one of your most prized loved ones, your child, your spouse, your parent? How would you process that? How would you process that? I mean, think about this for a moment. Would you wrestle forgiveness to the ground, or would you feel entitled to unforgiveness and bitterness? Isn't it sort of a marvel how we can walk around in this blessed free nation with grudges over small, small things while we've got brothers and sisters in really impossible situations that are forgiving the unforgivable? Why is forgiveness important? Well, that's just a touch of what we're talking about today. In fact, my guest today, he and his family were serving in a Muslim context when he and his daughter were having a daddy-daughter date. They were driving in the sand dunes, and a man came out of nowhere and aimed a gun at them. What he tells in his story is so gripping and so important for us. I feel like we have something to learn from Ray Norman. So let me not waste another moment. Let me tell you about him. We'll get him on the show. Ray Norman is the WASH Director of Faith Leadership at World Vision and former National Director for World Vision's program in the Islamic Republic of Mauritania. He and his wife live in Grantham, Pennsylvania, as well as in northern France. Ray, welcome back to the program. So glad to have you join us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Hey, before we get into your story, wondering if you've got a passage of scripture that you can share with us you've been thinking about these days.
Yes, I do. It's a passage that I've used in the book at least a couple of times. It's Psalm 57, 9 and 10. May I read that to you?
Please, I would love that.
Yeah, Psalm 57, 9 and 10. I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations. I will sing of you among the peoples, for great is your love. Reaching to the heavens, your faithfulness reaches to the skies. And then if you go back up to verse 5, it says, be exalted, O God, above the heavens, and let your glory be over all the earth. And that has been the prayer, that has been the banner that my wife and I have used over the years as God has called us to work among the nations. And it's our constant prayer that that his people will sing of him among the nations and that we will see his glory over all corners of the earth.
Great prayer, great passage. Thanks for that, Ray. Sorry if I put you on the spot, didn't mean to do that, but thank you for sharing.
No, that's fine,
yeah,
that's fine.
Fantastic. So give us a little context, if you would. Give us a little backstory in your faith journey, what growing up was like for you.
I'm American. I was raised in a family where my parents were deeply committed Christians, but they happened to be missionaries. So I was raised in the African bush country, as we call it, growing up mostly in very remote areas of West Africa. My father was a medical doctor. In fact, the first place we lived for about 10 years in my early youth was a whole day's trip by canoe up a river where there were no roads. So it was a very, very remote context. It was a very different childhood, but it was one that I wouldn't trade for anything.
And you tell a story in the book that a time when you were a child that your father was viciously attacked, and this was something that really would frame your life and impact your life for years to come. If you don't mind, as much as you're able, can you share about that incident and how it changed you?
Yeah, it was a formative experience for me. I was about 11 or 12, and we lived in an area where we always felt very safe, and the local people were very generous and very kind, and we really felt at home. But my father was running a rural hospital in northern Ghana, and some people from a very distant city had heard about the hospital because it had a very positive reputation. So they figured there must be some money up there. So some of these bandits made a trip up, and in the night they posed as patients. And my father got up at about 3 o'clock in the morning to go see what the matter was. And it turned out they were bandits, and he was very brutally attacked. He was taken out of town and badly beaten, and he was actually left for dead. And so the next day, early in the morning, he comes into my bedroom and wakes me up to let me know what had happened. And I was startled. I was shocked because he was covered in bandages and he was stitched up. But he wanted to be the one to let me know what had happened. And seeing that I needed some time with him, he had an errand to go to in the village. And it turned out the errand was that they had caught one of the bandits, and the police wanted my father to come and identify the man. So my father asked if I would come with him so we could have some time together. And it was a remarkable experience. We got to the small jail in the middle of the village, and there was an angry crowd around the village. They really wanted immediate justice for this prisoner.
Because they were angry on behalf of your dad because they loved him so much, right?
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. They were very upset that someone had come and attacked their doctor and put the hospital at risk. And so my dad tried to quiet the crowd, and then we passed through the crowd, and my father visited with the assailant, and he was not in a very good shape by that time. He was terribly frightened, and what surprised me was that my father... Dad took a personal interest in this man. Dad, inquired of his life, and found out that he had at some time in the past a Christian background. So my father pulled out a New Testament and began reading passages of hope and redemption to him. And the man was profoundly moved. I, as a 12-year-old, was very profoundly moved to see that in the midst of this man's self-inflicted circumstances, my father was able to treat him as a human worthy of God's love. It made a profound impact on me, Susie.
Wow. I mean, you think about how few people would experience that whole story. I mean, to think that you're at such formative age to go with your dad and people are shaking their fists on behalf of him, and he tries to calm them, and he's all beat up, and then he goes and extends love. I mean, you saw it modeled. You saw Jesus with skin on modeled before your very eyes, didn't you?
Well, I did, and it really helped me understand my father a lot better. I was, at that age, at 12, you're starting to kind of ask your own questions. For many of us raised in Christian homes, we kind of just accept our parents' faith. But there comes a point in your life where you have to start owning it for yourself, and often that happens between the age of 12 and 15. And I was beginning to wrestle with those things, trying to ask myself, what did I really believe in? And I was, at the same time, concurrent to that, I was discovering more of who my father really was. I had just taken for granted that he was a kindly doctor. But I don't think I fully understood all that motivated him from the inside, that he really was a follower of Jesus, and he took Jesus' claims on his own life very, very seriously, very deeply, and that really opened up that part of his life to me in a profound way.
Okay, before we get to your story, this is something I've been addressing on the show again and again. I'm thinking, man, if even a few thousand people can change their thinking as to how we approach what's going on in our world today, it could be a good thing. But your father couldn't respond instinctively that way without stewarding a godly perspective in the privacy of his own life. Do you know what I'm saying? Where if we just,
right.
And again, I'm just saying that what we're seeing in this ready, shoot, aim culture among Christians is not setting us up to love someone instinctively immediately after they've hurt, offended us in ways that are tangible. Your dad could not have responded that way unless, as you say, he took Christ's claim seriously and deeply loved even the people who opposed him.
Yes, and I remember quizzing him, you know, after this. And, you know, Dad also made a point to me. He said, Ray, you know, I'm a sinner as well. I have fallen short of God's grace, and I am just as much in need of God's grace as this man, and we all are. And if I can't demonstrate that grace, then why should I expect God to bestow it on me?
Good point, and I appreciate that so much. So we're going to be taking a break in a couple of minutes, so we're going to get to what happened in sand dunes that day on the other side of the break. But again, tell us about just how God led you, your wife, your family to be ministering in this Muslim context that brought you to in the setting where the story unfolded.
Well, as I said, I was deeply impacted by watching my parents, and we also grew up. The villages we lived in were usually desperately poor communities, and I grew up, Susie, with a deep sense in my life, in those younger years, that the world is not all a happy and healthy place. I mean, I was certainly aware that my lines had fallen in pleasant places. I had a family that was American. We could always retreat to the U.S. and the safety of the U.S. when we needed to. But I watched them, you know, we lived through civil war, we lived through coup d'etats, we lived through a lot of unsettled times, and we lived through a lot of famines and droughts. And I grew up with desperately poor people all around me, and I remember at a very young age coming to this knowledge, this acknowledgement that this world really is a hurting and broken place, especially outside of the borders of our own country here in the U.S. And, you know, at a young age, I wanted to do something about it. I asked myself at a very young age, what can I do to make this world a little bit better place? And so I met my wife years later. I was a graduate student studying water resources in the middle of the Sahara Desert, and I met this French woman who was out there doing the same thing and had a love for God, and we decided to join forces. We did not follow the traditional, you know, missionary route. We did not join a missions agency. Rather, I used my professional auspices as a water engineer to be able to go into countries where more typical mission work is not permitted, usually in Muslim countries. And we did that for about 15 years before eventually joining World Vision, which is a Christian humanitarian organization, and we were assigned to the country of Mauritania in West Africa, and that's where the story takes place.
Perfect setup. Thank you for that. Talking to Ray Norman of World Vision. Title of his book is Dangerous Love, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith, and Forgiveness in the Muslim World. Amazing story up next. Don't go away. More with Ray Norman when we return. God is faithful. He's so faithful. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. I'm talking to Ray Norman of World Vision. And at this point of the story, if you just tuned in, you can maybe go catch the podcast, hear a little bit of the backstory. But at this point of the story, Ray telling us about he ministering in Mauritania with his family in a Muslim context. And what brings us to this part of the story, title of his book is Dangerous Love, A True Story of Tragedy, Faith, and Forgiveness in a Muslim World. So this particular day, if I remember right, your wife is traveling. And I think she felt even a little unsettled about the day that you had planned. So give us a little bit of context there.
This was, at this time, it was a year 2001, and it was just a few weeks after the 9/11 occurrence in New York City and in Washington. And being in an Islamic republic where we were living, Mauritania is an Islamic republic, tension was very, very high. There were small pockets of sympathizers for the acts of 9/11. There was a lot of student protests going on because the U.S. had just invaded Afghanistan. And so tensions were very, very high. But we had made the decision to stay in the country and try to keep our programs going because there were hundreds of thousands of very, very of the poorest of the poor of the country that depended on our assistance and our work with them. So we had made the decision to stay put in spite of the risk and the tensions. My wife had to travel to Europe. She was part of an educational program, and I had to go sit for an exam. And my son, my older son, was away at boarding school, and I was left alone with my daughter. And when I took my wife, Hélène, to the airport, I remember she had a really deep sense that something was not right, and she really didn't want to leave us alone. And I wrote it off as she doesn't enjoy flying, and I just told her, I said, honey, you need a break from the desert, you need a break from this tension, and you just need to go and enjoy yourself, and we'll be okay. But that was my male thinking, and it didn't calm her fears at all. She left with those concerns, and at the end, she was right on.
Sorry, take it from there. So you and your daughter, how old is she at this point?
She was 10, almost 11, just a few weeks away from her 11th birthday. So we were the restrictions of the country had kept us in the home and in the school and the office, and those are the only three places that we had been able to go to since the 9/11 events some 5 weeks before. A few days after Hélène left, we got a call from government officials as well as the American embassy and the French embassy saying that the security alerts had been reduced. We could begin to move around town. We were free to use our vehicles without guarded escorts, et cetera. And one of the few things that you can do in this remote country to for leisure is to go out to the beach, because there's hundreds of miles of empty beaches where the Sahara Desert drops into the Atlantic Ocean. And so we had been basically homebound most of this time. So I suggested to my daughter, I said, Hannah, would you like to go out to the beach this afternoon and do a little swimming or walking before dinner time? And so that was our plan. So again, this was about a week after my wife had left. That afternoon, we headed out to the beach.
And you're driving. And how far of a drive from home to the beach was it again?
Well, we usually went to very remote location because, you know, there's norms of modesty in that country. So we would wear our swimsuits, but we would try to be in places where there were not crowds or other people. So we would usually go about 20 minutes north of town into a very remote area, and that's what we did. It's a spot on the beach where we would always drive to. It was about a 20-minute drive across the sand dunes, across a sandy track, and we took off out there. And just before you get to the beach, the sand dunes are very high. They go about 50, 60 feet high. And to traverse them, you have to deflate the airs of your tires, else you get stuck in the sand. So I stopped about a quarter mile away from the beach to let the air out of the tires. And as I was doing so, I was just thoroughly enjoying myself. My daughter was pretty hot, so the windows were up and the air conditioner was on, and Hannah was sitting in the front passenger seat. If I remember correctly, she was gazing at herself in the right rearview mirror while I let the air out of the tires. And as I was doing so, I heard a noise, and I looked up, and there was an Arab man stepped out of the sand dunes. He was dressed in typical Arab clothing, a flowing robe, and his head was wrapped in a turban, and he was carrying a small plastic sack. I didn't think anything unusual about it. It was a very remote area, but on occasion you would see a foot traveler headed towards the city from a distant oasis or a distant coastal settlement. So I didn't think much of it, and as he passed by me, he greeted me, and in Arab cultures, greetings are very important, and it's very rude not to stop and exchange, have an exchange. So I stood up and greeted him and had an exchange with him, and he was very polite. I picked up that he was very well educated. We started off the conversation in Arabic and then switched to French, and he was very articulate, so I could tell he was well educated, and that was a little unusual. And then he asked me, you know, who I worked for, because he was looking at the World Vision logo on the Land Cruiser. And so I explained, you know, that I was associated with World Vision, that I directed the program there. And I thought, because of my accent, he then asked me if I was an American, and I thought it was because he picked up on my accent, and I said, well, yes, I am. And everything was fine, so he said goodbye, and I thought he was going to ask for a lift to town, but he didn't. And I bent back down to finish letting the air out of my tires, and he turned and took about two paces and then stopped and called to me. And when I stood up, to my utter surprise, I was facing him with a pull gun. He had a 9mm pistol, and it was aimed at my chest when I confronted him at that moment.
Then what happened?
Well, you know, all of a sudden, all the pieces came together. You know, the heightened security, the tensions, the need to be careful, the fact that he had asked about my line of work, and the fact that the conversation had wound around to the fact that I was an American, and all the pieces immediately flew together in my mind. But I was hoping against hope that all he wanted to do was rob me of either money or even the vehicle. And I tried to engage him in conversation, and just this all took place in a matter of a few split seconds, and he never replied. And as I was asking him, you know, these questions, I saw that his hand tensed up, and he began to pull the trigger. So I just, you know, rather than just sit there and get shot in the chest, I immediately ducked, which I think surprised him. And I was one pace away from the front door of the vehicle. And I, you know, the only hope I had of getting away was to get in that vehicle. I wasn't close enough to try to wrestle the pistol away from him. He was two paces away. So I ducked and I lunged for the door and managed to pull it open and throw myself in. As I did, I grabbed my daughter, she had seen him, but she was not paying any attention to him. She was looking in the mirror. I grabbed her and tried to shove her to the floorboard, and as I did so, she was looking over my shoulder, and she screamed. She said, "Daddy, that man has a gun," and I turned, and he was at the closed window with the pistol aimed right at my head, and in that instant, he fired three times.
And that's where we're going to pause, talking to Ray Norman of World Vision, title of his book, Dangerous Love. A true story of tragedy, faith, and forgiveness in the Muslim world. You'll learn so much. The story is gripping. There's so much for us to know. I've got three copies. I'd love to get a copy in your hands. I think it'll just change your heart as you read. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Put Dangerous Love in the subject line. Give me your mailing address. We'll put you in a drawing. Three of you will get a copy of this great book. More of this amazing story with Ray Norman in a moment. You're having a great day today. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Ray Norman of World Vision, telling the gripping story of he and his family ministering in Mauritania in an Islamic Republic, and he and his daughter were having a daddy-daughter date, going to the sand dunes, going to the beach. And while Ray stopped at the sand dunes to let the air out of his tires a bit so he could make it over the dunes, and a man approached him and engaged with him and then pulled out a gun. At this point of the story, Ray jumped into his vehicle, pushed his little daughter, 10, almost 11, down to the floor and turned around, and it sounds like the shooter shot three times. Wow. Ray, take the story from there, if you would.
Yeah, thanks, Susie. Well, you know, my daughter screamed because she saw the gunman at the window, and you know, my hope had been to be able to jump into the car, and the car was idling. My hope had been to jump into the car and spin away before he could, you know, do any more harm. And so my daughter screamed because she saw him at the window, and I immediately turned around, and he had the gun aimed at my temple, and he fired three shots. But miraculously, the gun misfired, and it went click, click, click three times very rapidly, and nothing came out. It didn't fire. And then he, you know, Hannah, my daughter was screaming by this time, so he tapped the gun very quickly and swung his aim right towards her. And, of course, you know, as a father, you can imagine, you know, what rose up within me, because I realized at that point that he wasn't just out to get me. He intended to get both of us. And in my, you know, all of this is happening in split seconds, but in fraction of seconds. But in my mind, you know, I was thinking, if there's anything I can do just to get my daughter free, I did not think I was going to survive this. I didn't think there was any way I was going to survive it. But my hope was just to somehow spare my daughter from this tragedy. So just as he began to fire, I threw myself up against the closed window. I threw my chest and my arms up against the window as he fired. And that time, the fourth time, the bullet went off. The gun fired. And the bullet came through the window and miraculously went through my arm instead of my chest. And of course, glass exploded everywhere. It was a chaotic moment. I heard Hannah scream again, and I heard her thump against the door in the chaos of the moment. But what happened was, with the glass shattering like that, for his next shot, he couldn't quite get aim, and I saw he was hesitating, trying to get to see who was where in the vehicle. And that's when I managed to slam the car into first gear and spin off. At that same moment, he fired again at my head, and the bullets just missed the back of my head. They went into the back headrest of the car, and then he took out the back windows. So I spun off across the dunes. I put my head down. I really couldn't see where I was going, just to make distance. And after about, 50, 60 seconds of driving, I assumed I was beyond firing range of the man. So I raised my head up to see if, you know, what was happening. I suspected he had a car hidden and there was probably other assailants, but fortunately there was no one following, and I didn't see him. He had apparently run off in the dunes. So it was at that moment then that I turned my attention to my daughter, because I knew that she must be horrified by what had happened. And I had a very nasty wound, and I was shot through the arm and was bleeding pretty profusely, and I knew that would scare her. But when I turned to my daughter, thinking that she had gotten pieces of glass, you know, in her skin, under her skin, or perhaps even in her eyes, I turned, and she was curled up in the seat beside me, and it was only then that I noticed that the seat was very rapidly filling with blood. Hannah was curled up in the seat, and she was clutching her chest, and I still hadn't put all the pieces together, so I reached down to see what she was grasping, and I pulled the front of her dress and her bathing suit. She had a little summer dress over a bathing suit, and I pulled it down, and to my utter horror, I saw a very large, clean bullet hole right in the center of her chest, and the bullet that had gone through my arm had hit her directly in her little chest, and she was bleeding pretty profusely at that moment.
She asked, "Am I shot, Daddy?" And then she asked you another question.
Well, she started to look down, and I said, "Hannah, please don't look." And of course, I was trying to deal with my own panic, but you know, you tell a 10-year-old child not to look, the first thing they're going to do is their curiosity is going to get the best of them. So she looked, and she saw it. It was only then that she realized what had happened. She saw the hole in her chest, and she said, "Daddy, have I been shot?" And I said, "Yes, Hannah, you've been shot." And she very calmly looked up at me, and she said, "Well, Daddy, I'm about to die now." And I said, "Hannah, no. You know, I was clinging to any threads of hope I could, and I said, Hannah, no, we're gonna get out of this." But when she looked up at me, that was then the first time she noticed that I had been shot. And it frightened her worse than her own predicament. She looked at me and said, "Daddy, have you been shot?" And I said, "Yes, honey, I've been shot too." And she said, "Are you about to die?" And I said, "Honey, we are not going to die. We're going to find a way out of this." But honestly, in my heart, you know, I was throwing up petitions to my Heavenly Father at that moment, but practically I didn't see any hope for her, because this country did not have medical facilities like we have, doesn't have emergency room facilities. If the bullet was lodged in her lungs or in her heart or adjacent to her heart, there was no place where we could get adequate surgery to save her life. So even if I got her back into town, we were about 700 miles from the nearest good medical facility in the neighboring country. So I just didn't see how she was going to survive this.
And so how far did you have to go to finally get her to a place where you could get her some help?
Well, my first thought was just try to get back into town. There was a French doctor there, a French lady who was ran a small clinic in the town. It was not an emergency facility, just a very small clinic for minor cases. And I thought, if we can just get her there, maybe we can see what would happen next. Of course, you know, my world, Susie, my world fell apart at this moment. I mean, it imploded. And what was going on in my heart was that, you know, I knew God had called us to this country. God had called us to this country, and he had given us a profound love for the people. And, you know, what was racing through my mind was, Lord, how can someone who represents the people that we love so much turn and do this to us? I didn't have feelings of anger. I had feelings of hurt. You know, I was hurt. Here was a man that I cared about that represented a people that God had called me to love and had done this to us. And the second thing was that, you know, I believe God calls us to lay down our lives, to sacrifice our lives to the call that he leads us to. And my wife and I had done it, and we knew the risk involved in working in these countries. We knew it could cost us our lives. But I don't believe that God asked us to put our children on that same altar of sacrifice. You know, that had been my position all along. God, you give them their lives, and they have to follow their call for their lives, and I'm not going to put them in a place where they have to sacrifice for my call. Well, this was all going on in my head. This was churning through my head as I was trying to get my daughter to safety. I managed to get back into town. I was worried about passing out, but I managed to limp the vehicle back into town some half hour later. I had a cell phone, so I called our office and got them to notify the doctor, and I pulled up in front of the doctor's office, and she was already out in the front street waiting for us. And I remember she reached into the front. She opened Hannah's door and reached over and pulled down the front of her dress. And when she saw the bullet hole, before Hannah could look up, she looked up at me and shook her head in the negative, you know, and mouthed the words that there really is no hope here.
Wow.
She did not see that Hannah was going to be able to survive this at that moment.
My goodness. And so she got both of you in, and I'm sure you're saying, take care of her. Tell us what happened next.
Well, there was a functioning X-ray machine at another clinic across town, so a World Vision staffer jumped in the car and drove us with the doctor over to that clinic. We got Hannah under. And the amazing thing throughout all of this, Susie, was that Hannah never she started to fade, but she never passed out. And that gave me some hope. Plus, you know, she wasn't bleeding from the mouth, so for some reason it didn't seem that her lungs had been affected. So I was having these moments of fleeting hope for her. The other thing was that I had said, Hannah, listen, you know, you can help if you can just pray. I'll try to get us back to safety. And I remember during those 20-30 minutes driving back into town, Hannah started praying, and her prayer basically consisted of one word, and it was, she started calling on the name of Jesus. She just, with a very firm voice, she said, "Jesus, Jesus, Jesus, just get us home safely, Lord Jesus." And I remember she just called on that name for 20 minutes, and, you know, so there was hope in my heart. So anyway, we got her to the clinic and got her under X-ray machine, and to our utter surprise, there was no bullet lodged in her chest, but there was one down by her waist, and we were kind of confused, and we had not cleaned the blood off of her, so we started wiping the blood off, and it was only then that we noticed there was an exit wound in her armpit. And suddenly the doctor explained what must have happened, and the bullet had come in, it had gone through my arm and sufficiently slowed down so that when it hit her sternum, it slid across her sternum, came across her rib cage, and came out in her armpit. It exited and fell down into the folds of her dress. So the fact was, she was not in mortal danger. She was seriously wounded. She had some bruising on her lungs. We still had to get her evacuated, but she was going to survive.
And isn't it amazing that you turning towards that window, you really did save her life? I mean, really, your instinctive fatherly response saved her life.
Well, as I said, I figured I was already gone, but I figured if he got me, perhaps he would leave her alone. That was my hope. I thought at that moment that, Lord, you know, this is the time. If this is what you have, so be it. But on my way out, I'm going to do everything to save my daughter. Mm.
And Ray would tell you, when he recounts the story and people speak of his courage, he says it's not courage, it's just deep-seated conviction to follow Jesus, to live the life Jesus has called him to. We only have one segment left, and there's so much more to this story. You're just not going to believe it. Ray and his wife and Hannah got to go back to prison and meet the assailant. There was a pardon granted. You just can't believe how much story there's left of this. We're not going to be able to have time to get to all of it, but I want you to get a copy of this book. Write Dangerous Love in the subject line. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. And remember, I can't email you this hard copy book, so you got to give me your mailing address. Oftentimes you email me, but I got no hard copy mailing address. Include that. You'll go in a drawing. Three of you will get a copy of this great book. More with Ray Norman when we return. For the body of Christ, that we would experience such a revival of God's love, that we would know on such a greater, deeper level his love for us, that we can love those who oppose us, love those who hate us, love those who want to kill us. I mean, to stand in prayer, intercede, God, just as Jesus did on the cross, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Lord, open their eyes where they're blind. Open our eyes where we're blind. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, having a fantastic conversation with Ray Norman. If you just tuned in, oh my goodness, I want you to go back and catch the podcast for the rest of the story. In fact, Ray, I have this dream desire to bring you back on a second hour, because it's a two-hour show, and we'll re-air this first hour where you give all the backstory, because there's so much more to just your work there, what God has done since then. I'm praying we can do that someday. But let's take us to this point in the story. You were in the sand dunes with your daughter. You were shot. You both were shot. You tried to block the bullet. Your daughter had a bullet go through her chest. You now are at a clinic. You're bleeding profusely. She is too. But you just discover that the bullet exited out her armpit, so it's indeed not a life-threatening, but it is still a serious injury. And your wife is, I think, in France at this point, still doesn't know what has happened to you all. Take it from there.
Well, it was very... I was enormously relieved, you know, that my daughter was going to survive, and I just can't, you know, words can't express the relief that a father has at that moment, but we still had to get her out of the country, and that the World Vision, which is a wonderful organization, really rallied around us. They arranged for a medical evacuation plane to be flown in. This incident at the beach happened around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and between midnight and 2 a.m., the plane flew in, and we were both medically evacuated. And Hannah was flown to the Children's Hospital in Paris, France, where she was admitted for about 10 days and had some surgery and was able to recover. So we were, you know, out of mortal danger. But the the big issue then that was looming on our mind was our program. World Vision works among the poorest of the poor, and we were working in this Muslim country, this Islamic Republic, where, you know, Susie, where open witness is strictly forbidden. And our prayer all along was, Lord, are we only just doing good works? You know, we were doing great humanitarian work, but our question was always, and our prayer was, Lord, is this work demonstrating your love to these people? You know, how can our care for the poor demonstrate the love of Christ? How can we demonstrate what Christ comes to offer, you know, all of us in this very restricted environment? So our concern was, do we return? You know, everyone was telling us, our own pastors back home, we were on the phone with them. They were saying, Ray, you've been there for 15 years. It's time to come home. It's time to restore and heal. But that didn't resonate in my heart. It just did, nor in my wife's heart. And we did not want to step back into unreasonable danger. But at the same time, we didn't feel we could just abandon these poor communities that we were helping, because we were helping them in their time of need and vulnerability. And all of a sudden, when we become needy and vulnerable, do we pack up our bags and leave? What kind of witness is that? So we made the very difficult decision to go back. And Hannah wanted to go back. We felt that that rather than ripping her out of all that was familiar to her, her healing and restoration needed to start where it all began. So we made the difficult decision to go back, and after the doctors allowed her, some 3 weeks later, we returned to Mauritania.
And we've literally got about 6 minutes before we wrap up and pray. Can you tell us, bring us to that place when you went to the prison, your wife? I remember certain details of that story. Your wife was so brave. But bring us to that place, if you would.
Well, we found when we got there that, you know, our concern was, Lord, how are we going to be restored and healed? But just as a small side note, one of the things that really surprised us was that it was actually our Muslim friends and the communities we served that rallied around us and really spoke love into our hearts profoundly. And, you know, we learned the lesson of learning to receive love from those that you've been called to serve. And that had a profound impact on us. And then the assailant had been caught, and we learned that he was at risk of losing his life, and we felt we really needed to get to the prison to see him. And it was really my wife who was urging this, and we, after about 4 months of a lot of paperwork, we got the opportunity to see him. And Hannah went with us. She wanted to come. She insisted on coming, and we got there, and Hannah stood up in this crowd of people. We had been told not to approach the prisoner. He was across the room. There was about 20 armed guards. It was very tight and tight security there. And Hannah stood up, and she said, "Mr. Ali, I want to first of all ask you why you tried to kill my daddy," which is a very reasonable, you know, question. And I thought he gave a reasonable answer. You know, basically he said he was caught up in the moment with all the rhetoric on the radio and everything, and I think he just wanted to be a hero. And then my daughter, and we had not coached her, we had not even asked her what she intended to say. She said, "Well, Mr. Ali, I want you to know I forgive you." And under Sharia law, no one can forgive an assailant except the victim. No court can forgive a pardon the assailant. And so my daughter's pardon had a profound impact on him. And then my wife stood up and she said, "Mr. Ali, because of the harm that you inflicted on my husband and my daughter, surely you must be a man who has experienced a lot of pain yourself." Well, this, you know, the Holy Spirit was giving my wife wisdom that that I certainly didn't have. And this insight really struck Ali, and he had been fidgeting, and he stopped, and he stared at her as if, you know, this woman was looking into his soul. And he said, "Well, yes," and he began to share about some of the difficulty. He had had a very difficult life. His father had died at a very young age. And she said, "Well, you know, have you been reading the Arabic papers that say, you know, how Allah, how God must have been protecting my husband when those three bullets misfired that you aimed at his head?" And he said, "Yes, actually, I've read those articles. I get the paper here in the prison." But then he shrugged. He said, "I don't know. I don't know. Maybe God was protecting your husband." And then Helen looked at him and she said, "Well, Mr. Ali, I think the papers have got the story wrong." She said, God cares about my husband, but I think that those bullets misfired because God was really trying to protect you. You see, God cares about my husband, but you are just as important as him. You have just as much value. Your life is of just as much worth and value to him, and you are loved just as profoundly by God as my husband is." Well, by this time, she had everyone in the prison listening in. I mean, there were people hanging out the windows listening to this discourse. And then this is a country where it's illegal to bring any Christian literature into the country, and certainly illegal to pass it around. We've been told not to approach the prisoner. We were standing across the room. My wife then reached into her purse, and to my utter surprise and to my horror, she pulled out a Bible, a French Bible, and she pulled it out, and she walked across the room and stood by Ali, and she started in Isaiah and then worked through Romans and ended up with John 3:16, and she began reading passages of redemption and hope. She began to explain to Ali how a price beyond measure had been paid for him. And Ali he read each passage along with her. And when she was done, she said, "Mr. Ali, would you like to keep this Bible?" And he said, "Yes, please." And he literally snatched it from her hands, and he stuck it under his undergarments before the guards could take it away from him. And my wife swung around and confronted the director of the prison and said, "Can this man keep this book?" And the director of the prison stiffened and said, "Yes, ma'am, he may keep that book." And that was the end of our meeting. We were immediately ushered out. The next day, to our surprise, my wife had come by to bring me my lunch at the office. She had brought me a sandwich. And as she was delivering that, a large black Mercedes-Benz drove up to the building, to the World Vision offices, and I didn't know who it was, and a few moments later, my secretary said, "Ray, there's an important visitor I think you need to see." And this very elegant Arabic woman came in, and I didn't know who she was, and my wife and I offered her a seat, and she said, "Well, I am Ali's older sister, and I'm allowed to see him for 15 minutes every month, and I had my monthly meeting with him this morning." And he began to tell me of your visit, and as she said these words, she broke down and started weeping. And she said, as Ali shared it, he too began to weep and was unable to finish. So he wrote a letter, and he asked me to bring this letter to you. So Ellen and I opened the letter, and it was a lengthy letter, but, you know, Ali said that, you know, my life has been, you know, full of darkness. And I've always heard of Christian charity and love and kindness, you know, at a distance. But I think today I've experienced what you Christians call Christian love. And he said, I was so grateful for your visit, and for the first time, there is now light on my path. So we were, you know, Susie, we were overwhelmed that this whole thing opened doors of opportunity, because all of this got out of the papers, this whole prison visit got out of the papers, my daughter's forgiveness of him.
We have to pause here.
And soon we found ourselves in town hall meetings. You know, in Muslim society, you're not allowed to proselytize. You're not allowed to proclaim the gospel openly, but you are allowed to answer questions.
We have to pause here, Ray, because we have to end the show, but I'm begging you to come back. We want to re-air this hour.
Susie.
We have so many. I have so many more questions for you. Thank you for sharing your story today. I can't even describe how much it means to me.
Thank you so much.
God bless you, sir. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I want to get a copy of this book in your hands. Email me, Susie@myfaithradio.com. Just to be clear, when you email me and you send your mailing address, you go in a drawing. We will draw three names, and you may be the one to get this book. If you don't win it, go buy it. It's a fantastic story. Lord willing, we're going to get Ray back, and we're going to hear the rest of the story. This is just the tip of the iceberg. So much more. God bless you. God bless you, and we'll meet you back here next time.